The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
This is from Cultivating the Empty Field, the bright boundless field, since this is the boundless field Zazenkai, the name I took from Cultivating the Empty Field. This is a translation by Daniel Layton, Tygen Layton, and this is by the 11th century Chinese Chan master Hongzhi. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clearest circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just an expand and illuminate the original truth unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. An ancient said that non-mind enacts and fulfills the way of non-mind. Enacting and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you rest. Finally, you can rest. Proceeding, you are able to guide the assembly. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. Hope that's clear to everyone. Talking about our life. I don't know why, but I was thinking, last week I went swimming at the Y. And it was the first swimming class for 1 and 2 year olds. So this is the first time they're in the pool. I happened to be, they had a big chunk of the pool, so we had a lap lane. I was right next to them. And the minute they hit the water, wah, 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 all these little mouths in a big circle. And every time I swam, when I came up, I'd hear, wah, and then it would stop. It would stop. It would stop. And a few of them I tried to like smile at, and some stopped crying when they saw me because I looked pretty weird in a pool. And some just cried harder. They were like, wanted no parts of my smile. I don't know why that I was today. I wanted to sort of look at nurturing the body of truth, the truth body, the truth of our embodiment. They were showing the truth of their embodiment. And I thought, sometimes when I see kids cry, it's like what all of us want to do, but we don't anymore. Like they're just do it, you know, and of course we're grown-ups, so we can't just be sobbing all the time. Anyway, this is Hongzhi's teaching. This is his declaration of practice instruction that he offers us. And the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. It's interesting like that, because I feel like we're already in the clear cycle of brightness, and maybe we can make contact with that better. And sometimes we can like argue with the language, purify, cure, grind down, brush away. You know, it could sound kind of brass. Some of us may need to grind down our habitual patterns. Some of us may need to caress, whatever the acceptance word is of purifying, of brushing away. And it's not like get rid of. It's just that that's not where our attention is placed, perhaps. So this, he's talking about this awaken or this Buddhahood is not something created or achieved, neither existent nor non-existent. The essential practice, as we understand it in the Zen tradition, is to just to wake up to this, what he calls the empty field. It cannot be cultivated or proven. From the beginning, it's altogether complete. Can't be cultivated. So what are we doing here? Can't be cultivated or proven. It's already complete, altogether. Although we may realize more or less thorough vision of empty field, in practice, we're often thrown back to our habitual responses, concocted, I would say, previously from our limited human consciousness. So this practice involves observing our delusions and using what we might call an obstruction, using these obstructions or barriers themselves to clarify and illuminate this field, this fundamental field of awakening. It's through them where we know something is kind of going on in a habit way, and it's not helping. So we have to practice at grinding down. It's kind of like that, curing and brushing away the dusts, as they are called, until we can enact this awareness more pervasively, let it shine. I remember when I had I was diagnosed with something chronic, and I went to a workshop of someone that had it, and the title of her book that she wrote on it was, I Beat the Thing. And so after the seminar, I said, why did you beat it? Like, how come you had to beat it? I had to caress it. I do too much beating. I needed to be gentle and caressing. She was, no, I needed to beat it. And she went on to tell me why, that she needed to be so strong, like a, and she was a martial artist, so she was kind of very martial with her illness, and mine was much more gentle. Anyway, I did come through. It worked. So this body of truth, nurturing this body of truth, you know, I think you and myself and many that I hear from students, we kind of come into practice that we carry with us, that meditation or zazen would somehow fix something, make us better, like we weren't enough as we were. And that could stay with us, because Zen has a certain, the Buddha has a very high standard. And so sometimes in practice, we could feel like we're not enough. And then we don't know what anyone else is doing, but we compare with everyone else sitting still, like they're doing something magical and we're sort of like not. we're the one, right? So we carry this notion deep down, and we tend to come to our practice wanting to make our lives better. And in some ways that does happen. We believe that sometimes our sitting and our practice will lead to a future state of peace. I want to be peaceful, you know. But eventually we discover that the goal is not future peace. While the aspiration is to attain inner peace, be free from suffering, and that feels perfectly natural, we may have a subtle kind of aggression in us. I feel it as aggression, and also a deep misunderstanding that we're not sufficient as we are, that we have to somehow get to something we call peace. Like it's somewhere up ahead in some future time. It's not even around the corner. It's in some future hour, some future time. But as we practice more and more, we begin to see, oh, that the peace is always present. Our innermost being is already aware, clear, and unwavering. Not someday, but right now. And nobody gets up from their cushion and runs out the door. You might think that, but you don't. What keeps you? That this awareness is also not a state. It is who we are. If I'll use the word essence, the essence of who we are. It is the clarity, the spaciousness, and compassion of our whole being. The field of boundless emptiness that exists from the very beginning. It is. Now, we might think that awareness means we have to be aware of something. But awareness, as many teachers and meditation masters explain it to us, is not aware of anything. It's not aware, that is, in a dualistic way. So it's too simple and spacious to be contained as a little single thing that we're constrained by one particular something, right, that locks it down and the exclusion of everything else. Other things. As I was saying this morning, this part of our being is panoramic. And we can take it all in with equanimity. That's why I said move down to the hara and everything becomes much more panoramic. It's also, this awareness is not constrained by a sense of itself, a someone who is being aware. It's just awareness itself. We are awareness. It has no sense of a fixed identity. It is an empty, selfless awareness that we are. It remains grounded in every aspect of our experience, not separate from what it sees. It is a selfless, non-dual watcher. That's Shikantaza in a way. A selfless, non-dual watcher. We're aware. It's just awareness is aware. It's ordinary and it's present now. And because this awareness is stable in this way, distraction can't deteriorate it. We can have distractions, but it won't deteriorate our awareness. It's always functioning. It's our nature. Mindfulness can't even improve it. Awareness is what it is. Can't be conditioned or trained. It's just awareness. It's plain and simple. We have to, however, nurture our relationship with it. Nurture this body of truth. And when we first sit on the cushion, we may have trouble believing there's anything of that sort in our chaotic mind, full of churning thoughts and feelings. But we sit more and more, and eventually we discover that a very subtle, quiet consciousness is watching the chaos. The quiet consciousness is a witness that's not thrown off by the chaos of our relative mind. It's also not separate from the chaos either. So awareness permeates everything. I don't know about you, when I hear the word awareness, body isn't the first thing that comes to my mind. I think of mind. We might think of something much more refined than our flesh and our blood and this earth body. We might think of the brain. Awareness is in the brain. Words, such as knowing and perceiving. Awareness can be seen as, might be seen as something separate from our body. Or even from the subtle body. I spoke about the subtle body before, and I wanted to bring that up again. The subtle body, one teacher says, is like a pond, similar to the glassy surface of a mountain lake. The subtle body is mirror-like, spontaneously sensitive. It reflects every mood of your heart and mind, every physical ailment and pleasure. Its ripples are cues to the present state of your humanness. The subtle body is not purely physical, nor is it purely mental. It's an energetic layer of embodiment that bridges body and mind. It coexists with the physical body, but it's less material, less solid. It coexists with the mind, but it's more visceral and embodied. The subtle body is not subtle because it's mysterious. It's subtle because it cannot be received with our more dominant senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue. Eye, ear, nose. You cannot see, hear, or smell your subtle body. It is not an idea either. You cannot know the subtle body by just thinking about it or imagining it, but you can feel the subtle body. The subtle body, as I said this morning, is the vibratory aliveness that we feel all over our body. It includes the air on your skin, the sense of warmth in and through your muscles and through your nose, your veins, the body's subtle aches, our digestion, our breath. This is the subtle body. It even includes your mood, our mood. But it is not any one of those things in isolation. It's the whole vibration of all of that together. And to perceive our aliveness, our awareness must be open and relaxed. So this is where openness comes in. Openness is a stance of curiosity and wonder. And perhaps that's where Hongzhi leads us. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So I think he's talking about that rest in our awareness, where we can just sit silently and wander into the center circle of wonder. And it doesn't require we do anything in particular. It's not a social commitment to be open. It requires only that we find receptivity to what's happening right here, right now, to the subtlety of your own experience. We can feel openness in the body. And when we invite openness, our breath deepens, our heart expands, our chest lifts. That's why posture is important, because it invites openness. Then when we're crumpled, and it's an intervention with the rumblings or the rumifications in our mind. So the posture helps so much. We say open up. It's don't close your concave, your abdomen. Stay open. Reminds me of Kyudo. I never did the Kyudo retreat. In all the years that it's at the monastery, never did it. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's this, did you do it? No. Yeah. There's this one final when you're pulling back the bow, and you're like, and like, I'm doing it now, I can't. But, oh my God, it's so strong. I cry every time I see them do it, because it's just so open. When I look at Kuan Yin in royal ease with the leg up and the, and just like, whoa, that is so open. Our shoulders melt down, our back, our belly softens, our eyes raise a bit, our face relaxes. You can feel your heart and your torso in our face and eyes. You feel your pulse sometimes. So it sometimes joy, it's joyful to open. And that it requires courage to open. And what we don't realize, and I was talking to my friend, is that when we're open, we're actually safe. It's a profound protection, because it wraps around things that rubs against them, because we're open. So it's a protection, but you have to stay committed to it, or it won't protect us. So think of a situation, could be a couple hours ago or a minute ago, where you were rubbed wrong and that you opened to it. That's protection. When you open to it, there's nothing about, no boundary you had to put up. And that's protection. But when we're ruminating and we're lost in thought, locked in our world of ideas and opinions, we lose touch with the openness. And we're locked into that. So opening starts with letting go of being hooked on thought. It thrives. Openness thrives on being present. And we can get there through the body, through the breath. That's why the breath brings us to the present moment. It's not complicated either. It's just one inhale and one exhale, and we're here. We're home. If we can do that, we're home. Anywhere. It's so simple. But we don't want to be present for some reason. It's hard. So that subtle body So this body of truth is, as Hongdrir says, it's a body that's in this field, birth and death do not appear. It's a body that's birthless, deathless, boundless. And traditional sources call it this body of truth, or it's what we chant in the Milgatha, pure Dharmakaya, Vairokana Buddha, calling the names of the Buddha. It's that first one, Dharmakaya, which means body of truth or truth embodied. It's the body of truth that is more reliable than illusory appearances that arise, abide, and then pass away. Yet it's not separate from those illusory appearances either. The body of truth, this pure Dharmakaya, is the nature of those appearances. All appearances are the pure Dharmakaya, right? Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. Anything empty of any fixed nature, any thought, any phenomena. And while we are alive, this body of truth is not separate from the physical, the coarse body, this earth body that with gravity is here on earth, heavy, weighted, gravitas. It's the layer of embodiment that pervades our physical and energetic being with a sense of conscious awareness. It provides our earthly experience with a sense of cognizance. But it could be an empty cognizance. We're aware, but it doesn't have to be filled in. It's just an empty cognizance, awareness itself. Yet is not exactly mind. Mind is this restless, moving, fertile thing that's producing thoughts in one sense of mind. I mean, you look up Dharma and mind and you'll get a pretty good chunk of descriptions there. But mind is actually part of the subtle body that grasps at objects. It's the part of us that becomes entangled. Yet we can train the mind to be more attentive. But awareness is always attentive. Always. I mean, people come in and describe what's happening to them and they're not sure. And I'm just like, wow, that was such a beautiful description of like what you're experiencing. It's working. The awareness is working. It's cognizant. Empty and cognizant of what's happening. It's right there. It's the part of the self that is steady, unencumbered wakefulness. It's awareness lives in the now. It is just knowing. It is just seeing, just experiencing, just walking, just eating. Just is the important part of that. Just. It lives in the primordial first moment of perception before the world splits off from the one who sees it. The Dharmakaya endures in this moment eternally. So the earth body is the coarse body, and then there's the subtle body, and then this body of truth. And that's actually the subtlest. So subtle, we overlook it. We're distracted by appearances, by the parade of our thinking mind. And this awareness is more like the open space that the parade's marching through. That's awareness. The part we miss because it's so vast and ungraspable, intangible. To see awareness vividly, we need to look deeply within again and again and again. We need to commit to a path of ongoing insight. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. And while awareness is spacious, it's also not somewhere up in the clouds. We don't blast off. It's not even above the neckline. It's awareness is embodied. It saturates every breath, every cell, every surge of emotion. It pervades every corner of our living experience. It extends throughout emotional, physical, energetic, and mental life. One teacher wrote, awareness is not merely embodied, it is enworlded. I like that term, enworlded. This sacred consciousness is co-extensive with whatever it perceives, including the natural world, with others around us. And they go on to tell about recently, I don't know, in the field of cognitive science, there's something called the 4E cognition. Anybody hear of this? I hadn't. So I'll tell you about the 4E cognition. Oh my God. So it was adapted by this philosopher named Evan Thompson for understanding mindfulness. And he says, it posits that the mind is formed and structured by brain, body, and the physical and social environments all around us. He says, in this theory, awareness could be understood to extend even beyond the body. Are we surprised? He says, this idea may sound mystical, but it resonates for many meditators. The more intimate we become with our awareness, the more experience is limitlessness. So when we first start Zazen, our meditation practice, we want to do things right. We can be, if we happen to be an overachiever, we might want to bring perfectionism right into practice. Got to get to 10. If you have issues of inadequacy, this will follow too into our spiritual life. Or unworthiness, we're going to bring it all. It's all, Dido says, it's right in that backpack. And he always says, put down the backpack, right? And we can invest a lot of energy to build the perfect practice. Or we might try to make up for our perceived deficits by being good at meditating. But here's the thing. In the end, Zazen's not a construction project. It's a deconstruction. It's a practice of deconstruction. It requires letting go of the habitual modes of fixing and perfecting. Not so easy. The boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. We are accepting that this moment of experience is perfect as it is. Over and over. What's the belief that that's not true? No matter what the conditions are, it's perfect. So letting go of being a house builder, construction project, takes a lot of trust. We need to trust the potential of our being to find its way home. So I'll end with a little more Hongzhi. You know, Hongzhi was, Dogen was very interested in Hongzhi's teachings. And Daniel Layton says, this teaching of casting off body and mind, articulated both by Hongzhi and Dogen, points to the essence of silent illumination, which is simply focusing awareness on the totality of self to return and enact the bright, shining, empty field that is our fundamental nature. In the Flower Ornament Sutra, scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened one, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. This is said to be the utterance of Shakyamuni Buddha at the time of his great enlightenment, signifying the recognition of the inalienable Buddha nature of all beings. So, let's keep bringing it home.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.